WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and incentives and employee motivation in the form of huge Wall Street bonuses have gotten a lot of attention lately, and many people make the case that big money is the big motivator for success running banks or running them into the ground. But my next guest questions the relationship. Daniel Pink wrote the best-selling book about the often overlooked advantage of right brain thinking called A Whole New Mind, and now he's turning his attention to the often overlooked motivations for human performance on Wall Street or in the classroom that go beyond the bonuses or the good grades. His new book is called Drive: The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Welcome back to WNYC, Daniel Pink.
Brian, it's great to be back.
And you open the book with a thought experiment about encyclopedias. Will you let our listeners try it out?
Sure thing. We'll have to go back in time a bit, Brian, for this one. So let's say it's 1995, and let's say that we have on our show a couple of business school professors at, let's say, one from Columbia and one from NYU. And we say to these business school professors, here's what's going on here in 1995. We have two different business models for an encyclopedia. One of them is going to be done by Microsoft. Big company, Windows 95 is about to come out. Microsoft's going to be a colossus. We're going to pay our writers, we're going to pay managers to make sure everything comes in on time, we're going to put it out and sell it. That's one model for encyclopedia. Then we say to our business school professors, here's a different model for an encyclopedia. Anybody who wants to can contribute. They don't get paid. Anybody can change anything they want, and we will give away the product. If you were to say in 1995 to those two business school professors, I have a crystal ball here, and I know 15 years from now, 2010, one of them will be the biggest encyclopedia on the planet, and the other one will be defunct. Which is which? I don't think you could have found a single sober economist anywhere on planet Earth who would not have picked the Microsoft model. And yet, a few months ago, Microsoft pulled the plug on Encarta, and Wikipedia is the largest largest encyclopedia on the planet. And traditional incentive schemes and traditional economics seems to suggest that that's not possible.
So Wikipedia, which is not for profit, relies primarily on volunteers who don't get paid. So you're arguing that there is something intrinsic that motivates more people to post to Wikipedia than people to buy Encarta, obviously. What is it?
I think that the motivation to contribute to Wikipedia is a sense of mastery. People want to learn more about stuff. They want to make a contribution. And also, they're doing it autonomously. I think that's a really big part of it. And what I found in this book, looking at 40 years of research in the field of human motivation, is that these carrot and stick motivators, the things that we think are somehow forces of nature, the things that we think are just this natural part of how the world works and how business operates, carrot and stick motivators are very effective, but in a very narrow band of circumstances. And in many circumstances, they either don't work or they backfire. And the source of enduring motivation are these slightly more inscrutable things like the urge for autonomy, like the desire to make progress and get better at stuff, and also to be part of something larger than themselves. And in many ways, the whole open source movement, not only Wikipedia, but things like Linux and Apache, offer us some hints about what really provides enduring motivation.
And so you draw a distinction in general between what you call type I people and type X people. Explain the difference.
Well, it's really type I behavior and type X behavior. I mean, if we think it's just a convenient shorthand for describing it, some people, not because of their natural state, I think largely because of environment and context, are more motivated by internal things, by a desire to do good work, by a desire for autonomy, by a desire for purpose, than they are by external things. Some people are much more motivated by external things, getting the prize, getting the juicy trophy, getting the bonus, than they are by internal things. Now, it doesn't mean that every person who is a type X personality hates what they do for a living, and it doesn't mean that everyone who's a type I personality doesn't cash their paychecks. But that kind of orientation actually is really interesting because the science shows that people with that type I orientation actually do better at work. They perform at a higher level. They're also happier. And I think that, too, offers us some hints of getting beyond this single-minded reliance on dangling carrots in front of people and into a system that I think can provide, based on the science, a much more enduring, much more humane, and I think much more effective form of motivation.
So, listeners, maybe you're a manager in business or anyone else. Have you seen the difference between type I and type X motivations in your life? And if you're in business, in your business, did getting paid to do what you loved change things? Even if you got paid less, do you get disincentivized by money, as Daniel Pink says can happen? Or is that the best way to keep you motivated, as certainly happens in type X situations? Call us 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And how do you think this does apply to the question of Wall Street bonuses? Because the argument that the banks make for why they need to keep the huge bonuses, even when the taxpayer is giving them welfare to, you know, to pay them out, is that otherwise they're not going to get the super high-quality employees who are going to be able to turn the banks around and send them back to profitability.
I actually think it's a joke. The incentive schemes on Wall Street in general are so profoundly out of control. It violates basically every norm of fairness and equity. What you have there is, it's not even a bonus scheme much as it is, if they run a company into the ground, they get paid a lot of money. If they do a good job, they get paid an exorbitant amount of money. So it's kind of heads I win, tails you lose.
But
so
forget about fairness for a minute. The argument is you get what you pay for. And so if you have $500,000 to pay a CEO, or if you have $3 million to pay a CEO, you're going to get a different caliber of person, no?
You're going to get a different – you might get a different person. I'm not sure, actually, you would get a different caliber of person. There are plenty of people who will take a job. I mean, listen, $500,000 is not a pauper salary, okay? There are going to be plenty of people who are going to be sufficiently motivated by that, who want the challenge of the job itself. If the only reason that a CEO is coming to work is because he or she wants to get an exorbitant pay package, then that is probably not a company that I want to work for, and it's probably not a company I want to invest in. One of the things that's interesting, Brian, is how clear some of the research is. Let me give you an example. There's some research that shows that companies that spend the most time providing guidance on quarterly earnings, okay, quarterly earnings are an obsession, this sort of short-term obsession, and many executive compensation packages are keyed to that. Companies that spend the most resources and time giving guidance on quarterly earnings, they have a lower long-term growth rate than their counterparts.
So could there be such a thing as a type I bonus plan?
Absolutely there could be. Here's the thing. Certain kinds of incentives can run afoul. Incentives that we might call if-then incentives. If you do this, then you get that. Those tend to narrow our focus, make us very short-sighted. They're good for simple tasks. They're not very good for complex tasks. But there's also rewards that are what you might call now-that rewards. Now that you've done such a good job, you know, here's a form of recognition. So I think things like profit sharing within a company are perfectly acceptable. Everyone's in the same boat. Everyone benefits if the company goes up. I think that the outsized difference between, you know, often hundreds and hundreds of multiples between the people at the top and the people at the middle is extraordinarily demotivating.
Daniel Pink, my guest on WNYC, his new book is called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And if you're just joining us, he's talking a lot about type I or intrinsic behaviors and type X or extrinsic behaviors, people who are motivated more by external rewards. Sonia in Bay Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sonia.
Hi.
So?
Well, I was just letting them know that my kids, certainly I see that with my children, where I have two that are X and one that is I, and there is a huge difference in what I can, how I can motivate the one that is I. She sometimes I'll offer, you know, all of them, okay, if you do this, if you do that, then we'll go out and do something, spend money, whatever. And she's like, well, I am not sure. She looks at me like that's not really motivating to her. So I have to offer her something that motivates her specifically, like time time to spend an hour reading what she wants to read, or or maybe she gets to do something that, you know, the rest of us don't like necessarily join doing with her.
Isn't that interesting?
So I definitely see that with my children. You know?
It's good that you've noticed that dynamic with your kids. I'm sure it's helpful. Is there a parenting component to your book, which is mostly for business?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a little bit, and I think what Sonja says is actually really interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, I actually think, Brian, that our natural state is not to be passive and inert and do things only because we're fearful of punishment or want to get a carrot. If you look at a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old, I have not seen a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old who's not active and engaged. That's how we are out of the box. I think something happens along the way that flips the switch the other direction, which I think is dangerous. But let's Sonja mentioned reading, and I think it's a really interesting example. Let's say that you want your kid to read more. One, and I'm a parent of 3 kids, and believe me, at my house I've got a whole arsenal of carrots and sticks. And yet I'm leery now looking at using them now that I understand the science a little bit better. So if you want your kid to read, what you could do is this. You could say, little Brian, I'd like you to read more. I'm going to pay you $2 for every book that you read. I guarantee you, Brian, you're going to start reading. I can almost guarantee you. You're going to start reading. You might get out that library card and take out some books. You're going to be, in the short term, you're going to be reading a lot. I can also almost guarantee you that once I remove that $2, if I ever do that, you're probably going to stop reading. I mean, science is pretty clear on that. Because what I've done is I've said to you, Brian, reading is something like working at a fast food restaurant. It's something that only a chump would do without getting paid. And I'm not sure that that's the message we want for something as valuable as reading. So I think that parents need to be leery of a lot of these carrots and sticks. And I say that with a great degree of self-consciousness, because I know as a parent that carrots and sticks actually work in the short term and they're really easy.
Is the science so clear on that? Because the theory is that you pay little Brian $2 to start reading, and maybe he didn't want to read, he just wanted to go out and play baseball, but then he starts reading to get the $2, but then he enjoys it and he learns the intrinsic value of reading and it becomes something that he identifies with, then the $2 go away and he continues to do it.
That's the theory. That's what we think is going to happen. But most of the experiments, and there's 40 years of research on this, most of the experiments suggest that is actually not what's going to happen. The better approach is to for parents to model the sort of behavior that they want to encourage, for you to talk with young Brian and say, find him books that he's interested in reading. And so, the science, I mean, it's not incontrovertible, and there's some research going on now, especially even in the New York City public schools, about paying kids for grades and so forth. There might be kids who are so hard to reach and so lacking any kind of motivational nutrition that something that's akin to a candy bar might give them a sugar rush and sort of move them into greater nutrition. But I think in general, the science on this is pretty darn clear.
Phil and Tribeca may want to disagree with you on the Wall Street angle. Phil, you're on WNYC.
Hi there. Yeah, I both agree and disagree in some ways. I used to be a managing director at a Wall Street firm, and I've spent upwards of 15 years on trading floors. I know that the money motivation that works, in fact, the instantaneous money motivation, has led myself, my staff, other people I know, and the very, very smart people that I've had the privilege to work with, to come up with incredibly innovative, ingenious, creative ideas in order to give the maximum possible help to the customer and get the transaction. Now, as we know, in retrospect, creative, ingenious, and clever, isn't always the best thing. And some of the incredibly clever mortgage derivatives that people have come up with and other clever derivative transactions have resulted in bad things in the long run. So I think one needs a type of longer-term type of control over those type of incentives. But in the same way, a waitress in a restaurant, I come from England where tipping isn't such a big thing and service is not as good. The instantaneous incentive does make a difference to make people make that extra effort. And I think one needs a combination of the two types of incentives and that type of inspired short-term incentive, although it can come up with very inspiring and creative results. Well, I think in the longer term can be a problem too, so we'll need some kind of oversight as well.
Very interesting comment, and we're running out of time. Daniel Pink, what do you say to Phil?
Well, I see your United Kingdom and raise you Japan. Japan has no tipping either in its restaurants, and I think the service is much better because people care about their
work. It's a very different social situation there. I mean, Japan is very, very different. I think that's another.
Yeah, and the tip-free service is actually quite good. I think that, you know, one of the things that companies are experimenting with now to get greater innovation is almost radical doses of autonomy. So there's a company called Atlassian, software company, that does these things where one day a quarter they say to their employees, you can work on anything you want, any way you want, with whomever you want. You just have to show the results to the company at the end of those 24 hours. They call them FedEx days because you have to deliver something overnight. And that one day of autonomy, not a carrot, just autonomy, has produced a whole array of software fixes, a whole array of ideas for new products. You also see this with companies that are experimenting with 20% time, where people can spend 20% time working on 20% of their work time working on whatever they want. And so this is not a case against incentives of all kinds or rewards of all kinds, not at all. Mm-hmm. It's a cautionary tale about that these kinds of high-stakes rewards and carrots and sticks, they work in a narrow band of circumstances and are actually quite dangerous in some other circumstances. And if we really want enduring motivation, we have to recognize that people aren't horses and that they have other sorts of drive, the drive for autonomy, the drive to make progress at something, and the drive to do something larger than themselves.
The book is called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. The author is Daniel Pink. Daniel, our next segment is going to be about the CEO of Whole Foods, John Mackey, who calls himself a brown rice capitalist. Have you studied his motivation style at all?
Well, I mean, he's an interesting figure. I mean, he has very much what seems to be a purpose-driven company, a company that's not only about the bottom line. That is, he's a profit maximizer and a purpose maximizer. He's controversial politically because he's taken some political stands that run afoul to his what his customers think. So it sounds like a great segment, actually. I'd like to listen.
All right. Well, we will ask whether profit and purpose can actually coexist in one company when we talk to New Yorker writer Nick Palmgarten in a minute. Daniel Pink, author of Drive, thanks again. This is a great segment. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.